Okay, in the interest of time, I'm going to actually start this official meeting. And as a an unusual thing for System Thinking Ontario, I welcome everyone to System Thinking Ontario in a recorded session. We've had a long tradition over 5.5 years of not recording sessions because it was important for us to be engaged in the circle when we were meeting at OCAD. But now, since we're actually forced to be, everyone is online. We're all equal, and so we're going to actually record. So anyone that doesn't want their face showing up, you can blank. But we always start off the System Thinking Ontario meetings by going around and having people introduce themselves. And the question that we usually ask is, how did you come to systems? And so I'll moderate because we have a lot of people, and I'll see if I can make sure I get everyone. But right now, at the top, I see Stephen Regose. Dr. Regose.
Thank you for starting with me. I'm Hungarian by background. I left Hungary at age 13, and Hungary is filled with systems thinkers. In fact, that's one of the fundamental problems of the whole culture, is that there are too many systems thinkers. Coming to Canada, of course, I was tremendously pleased with the robust common sense of the Anglo-Saxon Celtics. And then beyond that, I had no systems background whatsoever until I encountered a book, Green, by somebody called Ludwig von Bertalanffy. Now, the name is Hungarian, but he was actually Austrian. I started reading it and I decided that in Canada I will be able to make a career working as a systems analyst. So that's how it happened. Thanks very much.
Great. And Stephen was a professor at Trent University and suffers those wounds, I guess, afterwards. Linda Craig, say hi.
Sorry, I was on mute. I'm hi. How are you?
Hi. Are you gonna say anything about how you came to systems?
Oh, sure. I don't know. It found me. I met David at OISE maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. I was interested and continued from there. So.
Thanks. Kelly Okamura.
Hi, I'm Kelly Okamura. I've come to systems through a background of change. I used to work in design intelligence and forecasting and came through design into systems through OCAD.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm going to have to ask people to also mute when you're not online, please. Zad Khan.
Hi everyone, my name is Zad. I'm a graduate student in the Strategic Foresight and Innovation program. I came to systems through the program, which was instructed by Peter Jones, who we have on here as well. And I've also been connected to David Ng as part of the Systems Changes Learning Circle and some of the team surrounding it. So happy to be part of this. Thanks.
Great. Griff Lubier.
Hey everybody, I'm Griff. Thanks for having this session. I'm really looking forward to it. I saw both of the Davids together in Waterloo about almost 1 year ago exactly, and that was a bit of a ruckus, so I'm looking forward to part two. And I came to systems through some familiarity with Bucky Fuller as a child, Buckminster Fuller. And then later through, I would say, Dunnellan Meadows. That was probably about 10 years ago or so. And it's been sort of a continued interest since then.
Thanks, Griff. Josh Harrower.
Hi. Oops. All right, turn that off. All right, so I came to this group, through Center for Social Innovation in Toronto, and probably also through the Strongly Sustainable Business Model Group. Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Shannon McGaugh.
Hi, everybody. I came here, I've been to last month and this month at the suggestion of my friend and neighbor, Elena Leonard, after some very lovely conversations about Fuller, Buckminster Fuller and sonic geometry. I come from an architecture and collaboration and music background and spend a lot of time researching sonic geometry and sympathetic resonance in collaboration. So happy to be here. I came last month and really enjoyed it. So here I am again and love all these faces. Hello.
Thanks. Joanne Dong.
I'm just trying to mute myself. Hello, everyone. Thank you so much. It's such an honor to hear David Hawk. David Inn has mentioned David Hawk so many times. I think the newest member. So I came to know David Inn just 2 weeks ago through chance, I think. So systems. I think I came into Russ Acuff's books back in 2014. That was a life-changing two books that I read. So that's how I discovered systems thinking. I came from a technology and architecture background. So, and David and I have some connections through IBM. We both worked for IBM Canada, but I think I might have run into you maybe once or twice through IBM conferences. So I'm really, really thrilled to be a part of this incredible group. I think it's a bit of overwhelming to me. Lots of valuable information and David Hawk. So I'm actually going through your PhD thesis just as we speak. I think you're so farsighted for your time. So it's such a an occasion for me. So I'm humbled and honored to be here. Thanks, David Inn, for inviting me to this group. I'm still exploring my way around. So so I'll be there eventually, a bit slow. And I apologize for that.
All of us are exploring, so we're still continuing. Aleem Khan.
Hi there. All right, so my background, I landed to systems from organization change management. So we were applying agile and lean practices, and I came across systems and then eventually landed up into Systems Thinking Toronto. I'm going to, it's my almost like 8 months, going to complete 1 year sometime in November or December last year, I believe. Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks. Andrew Bernier.
Hello. My name is Andrew Bernier, and I got an invitation from Jessica Wang to attend tonight. And I actually met her at the Relating Systems and Design Conference a few years back in Toronto. I'm not based in Toronto or Ontario. I'm actually not even based in Canada. I'm currently in Cincinnati, Ohio. But I originally facilitated a postdoctoral research at Arizona State University and their School of Sustainability over there. And my work was in taking a look at dynamics of systems thinking and systems dynamics and how they arise in education, particularly in curriculum design, and how more or less elements of living systems, so a nod to biomimicry, how can they be applied to curricular design models for learning outcomes. So, but I've recently relocated, and when Jessica had told me about this group, I was like, well, that might be a fun way of kicking something off here in the Midwest of Cincinnati and So I'm more just a fly in the wall, and I'm looking forward to tonight's talk. So thanks for having me.
Thanks. Seymour Hersh.
First and foremost, I'm glad I finally made it. It's been next to an impossibility to get down to OCAD for meetings. So I'm glad it's online so I can meet everyone. Historically, and I won't start when I was born, but I started off learning about systems thanks to Russell Acuff, and my initial career in information systems, and I've passed 30 or 40 years spending time on organizational change, which of course is all about systems anyway. So I'm really interested to hear certainly the presentation tonight and to continue developing a relationship with all of you wonderful, smiling, bright minds, because that's going to be an exciting time as I work on my doctorate, which will include systems, of course. That's why I go forward. So thank you, David Ng. Much appreciated.
Thanks. Robert Best.
Okay. Yeah, I live in the Markham area near to Toronto. And yeah, I guess how it's a little unclear to me maybe how I came to systems thinking. It was likely more informally through sort of following my curiosity and interest and in doing self-directed learning. Although I guess I started learning a little bit more formally about systems thinking after meeting David Ng, I guess it would be a couple of years ago at a peer-to-peer and D-Web meetup in Toronto. And he, I guess the pattern here, he also invited me to start attending some of these System Thinking Ontario meetups. Other than that, I have a background in mechanical engineering, though I'm now exploring things related to software for collaboration in the open source space. And I'll stop there.
Thanks. Peter Jones.
Hi, I'm, as many of you already know, that I teach systemic design and OCAD and the Strategic Foresight and Innovation course, which is a unique course on the development of advanced design for social system design. And it started as a social systems course 10 years ago. And before then, I'm lucky to have had a few mentors. So aside from my reading when I was in, I'll just mention one, when I was an undergraduate, Marshall Spangler, who was the father of David Spangler, who was co-founders of in Findhorn, had taught me about cybernetics and had a massive library and taught at University of Dayton, where I ended up going for my master's.
So, thanks, yeah. Peter. Nishat Garada. Got to find the mute button, Nishat.
Oh, sorry about that. Yes, thank you for having me here. And yeah, I'm really glad to be attending these meetings and meeting you all in here. I'm a very old student of NJIT and attended a lot of classes by Dr. David Hawk there when he was Dean of Management there. And he was the one who introduced me to people like Russ Acuff and Eric Trist, Kurt Levin, and their work at the Tavistock Institute near London in the UK. And and he also introduced me to David Ng, and I've been following David Ng's blog and attending the meetings facilitated by him since last year. I'm really glad to be here and look forward to a really productive time with you all. Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Oh, thank you. You haven't changed at all, David.
I'm trying to.
Samina.
Hi, all. I'm Samina. I kind of came upon systems thinking through just self-directed research. I was looking for methods that allowed me to think more holistically, because I hated reductionism and its pervasiveness in science while I was doing my master's in neuroscience. So I fell upon one of Daniel Christianwahl's book, Designing Regenerative Cultures. Started doing some more exploring, fell upon the Systems Ontario group, met David, and I've been pestering him to include me in groups ever since. And just on a learning journey. And I'll be starting the SFI program in OCAD come September.
Good. Stephen Sillette.
Hello. I've been involved in systems, I suppose. I got most involved having done some Theatre of the Oppressed work and looking at community development and the systems of the way people engage with each other. And as that sort of progressed over the years, I got involved with how organisations work and systems in different ways. So this is really interesting to see this group, because it kind of bridges a few areas of systems, which is what I'm interested in. So that's great. Thanks.
Well, you have to speak up next when you ask your question, Stephen, but we're gonna keep moving. Jessica.
Hi everyone, I'm Jessica. I first came across systems thinking back in school days and from more of a technical background, like engineering. Since then, I found that I still have lots more to learn, and I'm currently finding myself in the context of horticulture or organic agriculture, and wanted to apply it, sort of the system thinking in that context and see how it goes. So,
thanks. And Tim.
Well, I arrived 20 minutes late to avoid this. I guess you can't count on everything to work out. But early training, technically, school-wise, in what I was just thinking about, you know, I guess what the difference is, it's unreflective systems disciplines. So, you know, where they just dump it on you, the mathematical formulas, and off you go and design things. And so I guess my background is just an introduction to this kind of more enriched, kind of a holistic vision of systems thinking and such really starts with this group. Years ago, I just helped do some of the organizing with it, but I haven't been around a lot super lately. Big fan of the whole situation.
Thanks. And is there anyone else who I have not introduced? You can yell now or you can type. I think I've got everyone.
Mary Ann.
Okay, let me just say a few words there. Is that okay?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, just a quick thing. I'll be sort of doing the interview, sort of guiding the interview with David Hawk. Although those that know him, he'll just pretty well go anywhere. So we'll see how that runs. Thing I just wanted to say was that obviously I enjoyed my discussions with David Hawk. But the thing I wanted to say was, I guess I've been in the whole system thinking thing for about 20 years. And so it's taken me that long to really understand anything. And I think that occurred over the last couple of years with David. I had initially met David at MBA school. So that probably explains a lot if David Hawk understands what I'm saying. In any case, that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. So I guess the formal introduction I'll give for David Hawk, and then I'll hand it over to Dan, I entered the systems community in 1998, the ISSS meeting, and David says he remembers me from there, but I'm not actually sure I remember him from there. But the event that happened after that in 1999 was a conference at Villanova University where it was to honor Russ Acuff on his birthday. Was it 80th? Not knowing what I wasn't supposed to know, I didn't know that in effect everyone that was going to this conference actually had studied directly under Acuff. And so I submitted a paper, got accepted, went to the conference. And one of the most memorable things that happened, which was a very unusual sort of thing, I don't remember much about the conference, but I remember we had breakout groups. We're sitting around around a table, a group of people, and I was sitting next to this guy, and we were, whatever the discussion was, he and I were arguing against everyone at the table. And it was like, I was looking at him, and I think he's looking at me kind of like, why are you on my side? I have no idea why you're on my side. And so that started kind of a discussion. And then it kind of continued at the ISSS 2000, at the ISSS 1999 meeting in Asilomar. And then in 2000, the meeting was in Toronto. And the meeting was actually not a great meeting. It's not one of the better meetings. And so I remember that David and Mina Takala, who is his student from Finland, and Ian Simmons, who is my colleague from IBM Research, were sitting in the cafeteria at Ryerson, and we ended up saying, David, why do you come to these meetings? And he said, oh, it's meet interesting people like you. And I said, well, I'm actually working in New York, so we can actually meet down there. We don't actually have to come to these conferences. And so we started these bi-monthly meetings, I think, and in between NJIT and IBM Palisades, where we get together. And the discussion points were, number one, what have you read since we met last time? Number two, what have you figured out? And number three, what haven't you figured out? And that's pretty well been the way weird discussion has been for all these years. So since I know David so well, I've invited Dan to try to guide David as much as he can. These stories tend to wander all over the place, but I will make a note that David did publish the 40th anniversary of his dissertation. And there's a story in that itself, so I'll leave that. But the book is available. There were links on the System Thinking Ontario page. And I have to say, you're not going to get rich from that book, David. You're pricing it so low that it's really, you're really I don't know what you're going to do with that. Anyway, so Dan, I'll hand it over to you.
But David, I get a lot of angry letters from it.
You pay people today to in effect become angry. That's a good strategy.
Okay. Just a couple of things that we wanted to cover before we got started. Firstly, I don't have to tell you where the washrooms are. That's good. The other thing we're going to do is, I don't know where David's washroom is either, so that makes it easy. The thing is, we want to give people a chance to ask questions, right? So I asked David, so how do you want to handle questions? He says, well, you know, people want to ask them during his talk, that's fine. Also, we're going to sort of kind of do a check sort of an hour in to give people, a chance of, if you've been saving up your questions or if you suddenly thought of a question, we'll use that as a kind of a checkpoint. An hour in, I'll give you that. Now, the other thing is, now that we've got you all here, you see, the bad news is you've got a homework assignment. And David Hawk has got that all sort of set up and everything, and I've got the reference to the appropriate website. So too bad, guys, you're locked in now, you're being recorded. So sort of a bit of kidding aside, he's got a thing that he wants to kind of talk to you folks about. When we get to the hour point, we'll have him share that with you. Now, as many of you know, David Hawk has spent a considerable amount of time teaching and all that good stuff. And so he's had situations where, you know, students are falling asleep. Now, you guys could try to fall asleep here, and that might work. So I've asked David kind of explain the consequences of you guys falling asleep, and maybe he'll start that off by talking about the Tris story, the Volvo Tris story, so you get a feel for that. And then he'll start getting to the harder stuff about what's going to happen if you guys fall asleep while he's talking. Over to you, David.
Okay, in which order should I do that?
Well,
are there children in the room? You might want to have the children leave.
Okay, maybe do the other one first then.
No, I'm kidding. When I first started teaching in Stockholm in 1975, Stockholm School of Economics, I was teaching a course where they let me teach what I wanted. So of course I taught socio-technical systems. And so I had maybe, 15, perhaps a few more PhD students in my class on Eric Trist and systems thinking. And after 10, 15, 20 minutes, they seemed quite sleepy. Like they wanted to hear about Eric Trist. They weren't sure they wanted to hear about socio-technical systems. And they were, well, we might say, Swedish arrogant, if you will. And so they were, whatever. And so I chatted for a bit about their lack of interest in things. And so I still couldn't get interest. So then finally I threatened them, I guess, with the ultimate threat, which was, if you don't act more excited and interested, I'm going to take you to a porno movie. And then they got nervous, slightly interested, a little upset, a little funny. And then I continued to talk about Eric Trist. And then they began to doze off again. So I said, okay, let's go. And we went to a porno movie. Stockholm School of Economics never quite recovered from this teacher taking a class to a porno movie that wouldn't wake up. It's a sad case. Anyway, moving that on to what that means with Eric Trist is also in Sweden. You probably don't know it, but he was hired by Volvo to design a new factory and design a new work group process in that factory. It was the Kalmar plant in Kalmar, Sweden, and to be for a new model of Volvo. And so they put it into effect, very much of what Eric liked. Even this idea of the car being on a platform that turned around, went on its side, so the workers didn't have to bend over. And so there was this phenomenal set of mechanisms in the factory. But of course, the most important was the management system. Anyway, in order to dedicate and open that plant, they invited Eric Trist to come over for the dedication ceremony, which of course he went. He didn't realize they had done almost everything he said. He was somewhat shocked by all that. Anyway, they had a ceremony in the boardroom with all the noteworthies, as well as the press, talking about the use of Eric Trist. What they didn't know is that he has this sleeping disorder, where you doze off. You're not actually asleep, but you look like you're asleep. And so you can still hear people, but you're sort of not there. We knew him in class to do that quite often, and we're quite used to it. Volvo was not used to it. So when the head of marketing for Volvo was making a presentation on how great Eric Trist was, Eric dozed off. And so the camera was shining on the speaker. The speaker was looking at Eric Trist, and he couldn't stop speaking until Eric opened his eyes. And so for well over a half hour, he kept on speaking and speaking because he didn't want to be embarrassed that they would see that Eric had his eyes closed. Nonetheless, Eric did hear it and he was awake, but Volvo never quite forgot that tender moment of Eric pretending to be asleep. So since then I've had less trouble with students going to sleep. And in fact, I think no trouble with students going to sleep. Anything more on that point?
Well, yeah, you forgot the rate my professor thing. That was, I thought that was a wonderful illustration of how you work these deals.
There's a couple of dimensions to rate my professor that I had pretty high ratings throughout my teaching. And the fellow faculty were somewhat upset with that, but they sort of got over it. But once I got to be dean, I noticed that more and more faculty were rating my professor, which was me. And so faculty were using that as a way to pretend to be a student in my class. And so their comments began to be much more interesting than students had ever used. But in my evaluation rate my professor, the students made a big deal about me once being a motorcyclist, which when I came back from wartime, in essence, my recovery was based on riding around the country on a motorcycle. And somehow the students found out about it in one of the classes. And during that class, the students asked me if I would take my shirt off and show them my nipple rings. And I don't have nipple rings, by the way. But nonetheless, it was a major discussion point in that class. And then on Rate My Professor, it showed up also and became a shall we say, topical interest on ratemyprofessor.com, which, anyway, I haven't looked at that stuff in a long time, but it's still back there. I think what I like most were the faculty evaluations of me saying that I teach the same thing no matter what the course is called. And they said he just goes on and on about the same thing, and he never follows his syllabus, et cetera, et cetera. But those are cute comments. I like them.
Yeah, I suspect that your suspicions were aroused on these additional reviews because more students were showing up in your class than were registered in, I think.
Yes, I generally had more students than what were registered in the course.
That's really good. So the other thing I wanted to kind of share with people is quite often when I meet people like a David Hawk or whoever, I kind of look at who their friends are, who they hang with, the people they, you know, studied with, the people they grew up with. And, you know, those people are the ones that help me understand the person that I'm talking to. And David's shared with me, you know, the kinds of folks that meant something to him in his career and whatnot as he progressed through this whole thing. Would you be able to share some of those experiences with us?
Sure. Please don't buy the book that David Ng mentioned. It's too depressing. You may end up in suicide or something like that if you happen to read it. At least those are the comments that I get. But in that book, someplace near the introduction, I mention about a dozen people that were quite helpful in that book and helpful at sort of taking me into it and getting me and them out of it. And many of them are in the systems group. Some of them I think you've probably never heard of, which internationally or at AAAS, they're very renowned for a number of reasons. And they also mention systems. And in fact, almost as we speak, there's a new systems center being established in China, jointly funded by AAAS and NSF and a Chinese organization. And it's to the memory of General Shao, or General Shen. I won't go through the Chinese name, but in essence, he's most known as General Shen. And it's a systems research institute. He died in 2009, but pointed out that indeed, if he ever started a group, it would indeed need the word systems in it. Otherwise, it shouldn't have his name connected. If you ever go to my website, davidhawk.com, you'll notice a piece on there having to do with the movie Good Night and Good Luck. I don't know how many have seen that, but quite a memorable movie having to do with a prior low point in America, the McCarthy hearings, where in essence, a person gained great notoriety and fame by declaring war on commie lovers or people that associated with commies, and on and on and on. The important point in my posting, as well as in part of that hearing, was that there was a Chinese gentleman that in essence had, if not escaped, at least gotten out of China, moved to the US, had gone to Caltech, and had become one of the most illustrious professors at Caltech, and perhaps the leading rocket scientist in the US. Nonetheless, McCarthy heard that there was a communist, meaning Chinese, at Caltech and teaching about rockets, and that had to be dealt with. So he brought the professors that were friends in, but not General Shen. I use General Shen because that came late in life. But in essence, they called in the professors and asked, what the hell are you doing, allowing a communist to take over rocket science at Caltech? And went on and on. And finally, he was locked up for about 3 years and then sent back to China. That in essence, sent back without him wanting to go back. Nonetheless, he became one of the foremost rocket designers in Asia. He became in charge of rocket design for Asia. He also wanted to develop the economy of China. He felt the only way out for China was to have an economic system that worked. So indeed, he decided he had to start a company or two, and he had to start selling things. One thing the world wanted to buy was missiles. So he designed the Sukhoi missile to sell for hard currency. In addition, he started travel relative to hotels, restaurants, and airlines and things of that order. And he started a company called the Great Wall Trading Company. And he did all of this in terms of systems thinking. He was a very systematic person that could not think otherwise. Eventually, he became the most popular person in China. And as I'm told by friends in China, there are more statues dedicated to General Shen than there ever were to Mao. He was much more famous, much more popular. And the Great Wall Trading Company was a phenomenal exercise in how to do a company differently. I mention this because one day a student showed up in my class at NJIT and sat there, and within 15 minutes, we were best friends. It was a Chinese girl named Zehan Shen. She happened to be the daughter of General Shen. She had been the leader that had started Tiananmen Square uprising. And she did it because she said she's just like her father. And so she had started the war against central government, of which her father was an important part. And so she and I became instant friends. And she also was well-schooled in systems sciences. That led to the father arranging lots of trips for my students to China to visit companies and learn about companies. So it was a phenomenal relationship. And his understanding of systems was deeper than mine, more interesting than mine, and also led to some incredible change in China. Plus, he taught me a lot about China. So he was quite important. Others probably less noteworthy that you would know of course, would be Anatole Rapoport, who was terribly important. I loved our chats about many things. And one of the projects I'm working now on anti-strategy comes directly out of work with Anatole Rapoport. And in essence, how he was misused in Prisoner's Dilemma and misused by one of the great New York Times selling books, Tit for Tat, which much was borrowed from Rapoport. And much was claimed that he was very strategic when you could not find a more anti-strategic person. Nonetheless, Rapoport is important on and on. But maybe stepping back just a little bit and maybe saying a little bit in parallel to what all of you have done on how you got introduced to systems thinking. I think I probably was never introduced. I think for me, it was perhaps the only way of thinking. It was either systems thinking or non-thinking. I couldn't envision a third alternative. And this started when I went away to college, which I'd mentioned to Dan. Grew up on a farm in Iowa, spent 18 years working on the farm, then sort of going to school, but not really. In high school, I was banned from college preparatory classes. I couldn't take English or math for preparation, in part because I was in the agriculture section. And as president of the agricultural group, I found it disgusting that the school had this process of, over the weekend, farm kids were to go out and kill pests, meaning things like birds, rats, maybe rabbits, porcupines, whatever. And on Monday morning, they would bring them into the school, either cut their heads off, cut their tails off, or legs off, as evidence they had done good work and helped humans. And then take them to a counter, lay them out. The teachers would count the remains and give you points. And I thought that was disgusting. And so I lobbied against that. By lobbying, I became president of the chapter. And then I got it discontinued for 1 year, which they did. But because of that, the school banned me from taking college preparatory courses in that I should never go to college. A person like me had no room in college. Nonetheless, in line with that, I had an uncle who I quite disliked, and he disliked me. And he advised me, you should never go to college. That's where idiots go. Stay away from college. Then he said, but if you go to college, never go to Iowa State University. It's the hardest school I know of, but don't go there. Then he went on and said, if you go there, don't study electrical engineering. It's the hardest subject at Iowa State, and do not touch it. Then he quit. So of course, what choice did I have? I had to go to college, had to go to Iowa State, had to study electrical engineering. What really got me started with systems was my first course in physics. The instructor was talking about the laws of thermodynamics, and he skipped over the second. And so I raised the question in class, aren't you going to talk about the second law of thermodynamics? He said, no, that's not part of this curriculum. That's not part of this university. That's a waste of time. And don't bring it up again. Then I knew I was onto something. By God, that was worth knowing about. So anyway, that got me started on thinking of expanding things, not contracting. So thus, systems for me became expansion and not contraction. And that went on and on. And I spent 3 years at Iowa State studying electrical engineering. One day I mistakenly went into a lecture auditorium where there was a lecture by an architecture professor named Vernon Stone, who was lecturing on the future of humanity and why brutalistic architecture had to be the future. Because humans needed control more than anything else. And brutalistic concrete would control humans. They pay respect to it, they're scared of it. So all of your buildings have to be out of concrete. It has to be rough concrete. And I thought, oh my God, I've come home. And so the same day I transferred to architecture because I wanted to do battle with this, shall we say, asshole. I could never get over that lecture. So then I spent another semester. My local draft board sent me a letter saying that you think you're very smart. You transferred from a 4-year curriculum to a 5. You think you'll avoid the draft and avoid Vietnam for an extra year? Well, we're here to tell you you're not going to. You're not that smart. And I said something to the order of, F you, if you want me, take me now. And I said that only because I knew they couldn't, because by law they weren't allowed to. Guess what? They took me now. And so then I got to take a trip. Anyway, I came back, went to Iowa State again, eventually after I quit the motorcycle gang. They're the ones that taught me into going back and finishing. Went back and spent 3 more years completing my degree. It's worth noting, first 3 years, I had a 2.3 average. The next 3 years, I had a 4.0 average. And at the end of my degree, the Faculty of Engineering awarded me a one-time prize, which was, David Hawk is the scariest student we've ever had. That was a sweet prize. Anyway, I left there and I went off to Germany to work with a man that I had hired to be one of the faculty at the School of Architecture. And he was also in the competition for the, remember the Munich Olympic site? München 72. Anyway, I went back and worked with him on that competition. He won the competition. And so because he won, lots of people came through his office. A delegation from Westminster Council, including the chair of it, came to visit his office. And they pointed out, we've had a tough time getting suitable people to work in Westminster Council. Do you have anyone you'd recommend? Hans Beinisch, my friend, my boss, turned and looked at me and said, hire David Hawk. You must hire him. So they hired me immediately. No interview, no resume, no nothing. They hired me. I went to London to work. While working in London, one of the there were two projects that are noteworthy. And one project, I was working with a woman named Margaret Thatcher, who was Secretary of Education at the time. She was the first one to fire me. We didn't get along well. I won't go into the reasons. Then I had the project of redoing Piccadilly Circus. We had a designer's plan and a developer's money stacked up to replace Piccadilly Circus with three towers. I came out against it. And they said, no, you're to argue for it. I said, no, it's ugly. Why would I argue for it? Anyway, we had quite a fight over it. And they said, nonetheless, you are going to get that built. So I arranged for a protest movement of citizens of London to come to an exhibition. You may not know it, but there's a funny publication in London, which I gave them the drawings for that project. The publication's called Punch. They went away and they came back with a fold out in Punch magazine that everyone in London essentially saw, which was a giant horrible monster squatting over Piccadilly Circus, pooping out these buildings that were designed for Piccadilly Circus. That won the day. It was defeated. I was fired. While I was there, I had hired a person named Edmund Bacon. I don't know if any of you know of Edmund Bacon, one of the grandest people I know, one of the greatest urban designers that ever lived. He wrote a book on urban design, which is the classic book. Anyway, he came to me and said, David, I think they're going to fire you. I've been advising this project, but as soon as they fire you, come to University of Pennsylvania. You can be my research assistant. So please come. And I said, where's the University of Pennsylvania? I've never heard of it before. And he said, I'll come to Philadelphia and ask anybody. They'll point you. So I said, fine. Anyway, I did get fired. A month or two later, I did decide to go see Edmund Bacon. So I went to Philadelphia, found the university. Indeed, he did the paperwork to get me admitted to a dual degree program, be his teaching assistant and research assistant. So after one semester of taking architecture courses at Penn, the architecture faculty had a meeting, made an agreement that David Hawk should never take an architecture course again, that we do not want him. There was one dissenting vote I was happy to hear. That was the funny man mentioned here before, which, anyway, I'll come back to that. Anyway, he argued to keep me, but the rest decided not to. So they gave me a contract. I would get my degrees, but I had to take courses around campus. I couldn't take an architecture course. I had to not touch them. So that allowed me to go out around campus and take fantastic courses from fantastic people. One of the first was Russ Olikoff. And as soon as I was in that course, I knew I was home. It was phenomenal. So I took his courses. Then I talked to him about what else can I do. He said, go see Eric Trist. Doesn't matter what it's called, take his courses, which I did. And then I was home free. I couldn't believe the people I'd met. Also met people in other schools, the Annenberg School of Communication, Social Sciences. I took a course on holography in electrical engineering and learned how to make holographs, which was phenomenal. I never got over. Anyway, I finally finished up those two degrees, and I had to do a thesis for city planning to get one of the degrees. So I wrote a thesis. The thesis was called The Communication Alternative from Moving Mass to Moving Ideas. And it was a thesis about building a telecom city, meaning people would only interact vis-a-vis telecom. In essence, it was a joke, but it's a thesis I really enjoyed. And it was a way of getting rid of city planners, concrete, construction people, all those people I didn't like and didn't like their courses. Anyway, I failed the thesis. The planning faculty were furious. A day later, Russell Olikoff talked to me and said, David, we're starting a new program on systems. It's going to be a new PhD program. Would you please join us? And I said, sure, as long as I don't have to fill out a form, take a test, or make an application. Russ said, I'll do that for you. Don't worry about that. I said, but a problem is that my master's degree is now an F in city planning. Architecture was fine, but in city planning, they flunked me. He said, we'll go see them. So he and Eric Trist went to meet with the planning faculty and talked about my thesis. And somehow they managed to get an A out of the planning faculty for my thesis. So I got to go into this program. And I had arrived at the systems thinking people. So there are many others that were quite important, but Russell Acuff, first and foremost. Second would be Eric Trist, very much so. But behind that were other people that laid the basis, Edmund Bacon, et cetera, et cetera. And probably most important for me discovering this idea of expansionism, not contraction, was all the trouble I had everywhere with everyone. It was very helpful. It made a big difference. Sorry for taking that so long, but it got me up to Russell Acuff and Eric.
So David, did you want to share the how you helped the, I guess, the elite in China solve their problems?
Well, it again goes back to General Shan and his daughter. And because of them, Tsinghua University invited me to be a guest professor. Probably most of you don't know Tsinghua. It's considered China's leading university. And if you go in the area of computer science and look at the international evaluations, they are generally number one. Let's see, there's eight categories for computer science, and they are number one in three, I think number two in two. MIT and the American version of schools are sort of five, six, seven, whatever. Anyway, based on my relationship to General Shan and his daughter, they invited me to come and be a lecturer, a lecturer at Tsinghua. And the department they wanted me to be in was public policy and management. That was the official title. So I agreed to go do that and had a great time. It was great. I worked with a professor within that who was head of the department, also head of the leadership program at Tsinghua. And he and I became very good friends. He would come and go to New Jersey. I would come and go to Beijing. Every now and then he would give me some advice saying that when you give a lecture, never mention names. That the school is a little sensitive about names that you mention. And so you can criticize people, but don't say their name. Anyway, except for that, we got along very well. at one point, he wanted me to have a debate over what I talked about in my lectures with what was called the Experts Council of Beijing. The Experts Council of Beijing, which you see on that slide off to my left, it's about a dozen gentlemen, no ladies. All the way to the left is the head of the armed forces of China. All the way to the right is the security forces head of China. The second one from the left is head of the Communist Party of China. The somewhat elderly gentleman next to me was Chairman Mao's personal secretary the last 15 years of his life. He was quite instrumental in working with Nixon on getting the opening up of China. And next to him is chairman of the Experts Council. And then next to him is my professor friend. This is part of them. So they asked me to come and give a lecture about some of my innermost feelings about China and what it should do for its future. And so I began to give this lecture and they asked me to stop. And the chairman said, this is supposed to be a luncheon that we're going to have. And I think based on what you've said, we're not going to have a luncheon. Instead, we're going to have a drinking competition. And so everyone's allowed to speak as long as they do a bottoms up. So each person, if you want to speak, do a bottoms up and raise your hand, and then you're allowed to speak. And you can speak as long as your bottoms up doesn't get to you. And so we had this debate for 2 hours. And the essence of the debate was that I argued China should get beyond Confucius, that Confucius was not serving them well. Too much orderliness, too much stability, too much obeying the rules, that in essence, China needed to find a way to go back to the wisdom of Lao Tzu and dump Confucian thinking. And it was quite a competition. And it was great fun. I really enjoyed it. I even commented that I could never have such a debate in Washington. Anyway, at the end of the debate, the chairman, who's a calligrapher, went away and summarized the debate in this calligraphy that he is working on. So you can see in the photo. Can everyone see that?
Yep, I think so.
Okay, the photo to
left. Yeah, we see it.
Yep.
He is summarizing the conclusion we reached. And you'll notice that same calligraphy is now over my dining room just behind me. And so they had it framed and sent to me. But in essence, what that says, or so I'm told, is that Professor Hawk is right. We do need to find a more natural way to regulate, as well as a more natural approach to industrialization, economic development, and many things. So he is right about that. And we need not to be so tough on each other and have all of this mean regulation. But, and the but is perhaps most interesting, but our question is, what do you do with the idiots and assholes? And they concluded their poster with that comment. And that was the conclusion of our debate as well, which I greatly enjoyed. And I've maintained contact with some of them. This was in 2007. In 2012, the person that was going to become the next president, President Xi, came to Iowa and spent some time in Iowa trying to find out about Iowa and revolution and things like that. Then went back and was selected as the person to head up China. At least with his friends, I argue about a lot about China, even more than I did before. But maybe the concentration is that last phrase they were worried about, and they've expanded on that a bit too much. Anyway, that was some of my work in China. The last little piece I'd like to mention, if I might, is the Eternal Feminine Foundation, if that's okay.
Yeah.
That in 2015, I was quite concerned about a person called Donald Trump becoming president of the US. And since I knew Donald from two episodes in the New York area, one in Atlantic City, one where we received a joint award in New York City for something, and I refused to go to it, which made a lot of trouble, I hear. Nonetheless, in 2015, I thought that Donald Trump would become our next president. Excuse my language, but people want to know why I thought that. I argued that America had an incredible case of, you simply can't go to the bathroom. You're constipated. And so America was a constipated country. And it was all set up to have a good case of diarrhea. And so I felt that Donald Trump would be our diarrhea. And so in line with that, I started a foundation in China, which was called the Foundation of the Eternal Feminine, and got some people to help me with it. Those people convinced some of the richest men in China, owning some of the largest companies, but also which only had a daughter, no son. They contributed $650 million to this foundation called Foundation for the Eternal Feminine. It was to prepare humans for climate change, and particularly prepare women to be in charge and be leaders of organizations during this thing we're going to call climate change. So this was about climate change and how to find leadership in the next 30, 40, 50 years to deal with the rough spots. The foundation did quite well initially. It was to have half girls from the richest of the richest families, and half of the girls were to be from the street. They were to be young girls that the families couldn't support or didn't want, or because they were a female, there was no need for them. They were dumped on the street. So the foundation was to be 50-50 between these two groups, and you can imagine the mess that would have caused. And I thought that was fantastic. Anyway, at some point, the board of the foundation, and I was going to move it to New York City, but then the Chinese government put several million in, thus it couldn't be moved anymore. And then the board, at some point, probably under my comments, I don't know, they made a comment that we need, well, either you do a sex change operation or we have to find a new chair of the foundation. And so I was up for it, but they thought that was a bit much. And so they found a new head of it. And the woman that owns the largest beer company in China was thought to be the perfect head for such a foundation. In essence, I have very little to do with it anymore. It still sort of stumbles on, but they got rid of the poor girls because, you know, why would you tolerate poor girls picked up off the street? I mean, you know, why bother, et cetera, et cetera. So my relations with China are quite good, but quite long.
Now, David, just one thing that I know that you're very, it's very passionate as far as your view of education, in at least in the United States, is your concept of consequential management, particularly around the business schools. Perhaps since a number of us have gone through that path, maybe it would be a good sort of opportunity for you to kind of share your thoughts of where you see the breakdowns in terms of the assumptions, the, you know, the Harvard case method, that kind of stuff.
Sure. Maybe going back to pick up with the social system science program that Acuff started, and indeed he did start it. As I put in the notes, the only reason the Wharton School would accept a program in system sciences is if you put social in front of it, because they hated socialism. And so they knew it would die if you put social in front of any program. So they agreed to Acuff's program. Nonetheless, the program did extremely well and attracted all kinds of really good people. And I really quite liked it. It's worth noting that at the end of the classes that were required for the PhD, I then decided to go to Sweden. And when Russ heard that, he was furious. And I got to hear Russ's swear words in the hallway to me about, we've invested all these years in you, and now you're leaving. You're not going to do research with us. If you do this, I will never speak to you again. You'll never get a PhD, and you'll never be allowed back again. And in David Hawk manner, I said, bye, Russ, I'll miss you. I didn't kiss him, I just said, I'll miss you. And I left and went to Sweden. And I went to Sweden because a fellow student named Gunnar Hedlund, who came into the program only to be around Trist, Osbakan, and Acuff. He was getting his PhD at the Stockholm School of Economics, which he thought was more appropriate than the Wharton School of Finance. He and I became best friends during that period of courses. And so in essence, he was the one that arranged for the dean of the Stockholm School to come visit the program and interview me. And he interviewed me and decided that, yes, you do have a job at the Stockholm School of Economics whenever you want. This is when Acuff went berserk. I mean, he really was upset. Nonetheless, I went to Sweden. About a year later, I sent him a ticket and a $5,000 check from our institute to come and give a guest lecture, which he did, which was very good. Now, let me mention the institute. One of the reasons I went to Sweden was to work with Gunnar Hedlund on establishing a new kind of institute, a new kind of teaching. And this was to be in the Institute of International Business, Stockholm School of Economics. And we were to teach students how to prepare for a world where nationalism was much less important an international business would be a vehicle to try and do better with the planet. And so Gunnar and I started this institute. We raised about $100 million to start the institute. We had 26 PhD students, where each had a first-class business ticket, open-ended, to go anywhere they wanted without permission. And each could go any place in the world and work. We just asked them to check in at least once a year and let us know they're still alive. But they were to do a PhD that mattered. So in essence, we attracted students that would not normally be in a business program. They would normally be in hard sciences or law or medicine, but they liked the sound of this program and they came into it. In addition, I think I mentioned to Dan that one of our recruiting vehicles was, you know, I have this passion for finding losers. And so in all of my teaching at the universities I've taught at, I've always asked for the losers to come and talk to me, because I'm somehow, I feel akin with losers. And so in this case, the losers were people that other professors in that school or other schools in Stockholm had kicked out of their program or refused to admit under any conditions. And so we would have lunch with these professors and they would explain the losers that they had skipped over or avoided. So then we would have lunch with that student and in most cases accept them into our program. And thus, we ended up with very different students in very different courses. And this is where we began the idea of business as unusual, how to get over business as usual. Because we felt in the future, business as usual would mean no business. Business as unusual was an open ticket to all kinds of things. Of course, this relates to Schumpeter and economics, and then Schumpeter's favorite student, Nicholas Georgescu-Rosen, which then became one of my very good friends. So in that particular program, it was called EEB, IIB, at the Stockholm School of Economics, we did a lot of very interesting things. Now, the Stockholm dean wanted to control us, but we managed to put the $100 million in a fund he couldn't touch. And we had a board of directors, which were the leading business CEOs of Sweden. So in essence, they couldn't touch our institute. To launch this institute, I started a very controversial research project, as in extremely controversial, having to do with regulation of environmental protection, how to regulate what humans were doing to the earth. That was to be the first project in this institute and launch it. And so I began this two-year project. Now, to start the project, I needed companies involved. So I needed some of the petrol companies. So based on interviews, I was told the worst of the worst is Texaco. They are the worst company in America and the worst petrol company. So I went to visit with them, knowing that if they took part, everybody would take part. Because if the worst of the worst takes part, the others have no fear. They took part. So I got Exxon, Dow, Texaco, et cetera, about 20 companies to take part in this study. What they had to do was give me access to their plants in various countries, and then allow me to study what they had done relative to the regulation of the country. So it was a study of regulation, not of the companies. So we had this two-year project. Six governments signed on to take part, and 20 companies took part. I spent 2 years in lots of plants all over the world doing this study, and we came to a lot of interesting conclusions. Anyway, at the very end, the last presentation on the project, chief scientist at Exxon made a presentation on climate change. That was the first I had heard of climate change. He made a presentation on why, if Exxon keeps on doing what it does, it guarantees climate change for the world. That was a phenomenal presentation. Anyway, based on that, that became the basis for me doing climate change vis-a-vis systems thinking. Based on a three-volume report that came out of my two-year research, the Prime Minister of Sweden made a presentation to OECD on environmental regulation and warned them not to follow the American model in all instances, avoid the American model, or you're doomed to not do well and create cynicism. And that was a very popular lecture that he gave OECD. Anyway, based on that lecture and based on the reports being sent around, Russell Acuff called me. David, I've just read your three volumes. This is exactly why we started a system science program. You could not have been more spot on. And I'm very sorry for our last conversation, but I just didn't get it. And so would you please come home and get your PhD? It's done. Based on this, I will make sure a committee awards you a PhD. Anyway, about a year later, I did go back and stopped in to visit with he and Eric Trist. And Eric said, no, those three volumes are empirical. They are not a dissertation. Please go write, what is the theory behind what you say in those three volumes? Otherwise, I will not approve a PhD. Must have a theory. So I went away, and about 6 months working in the evening, I wrote 300 pages or so of a dissertation. And the dissertation was about why the results emerged that they had emerged in the study. I submitted it. Russ was not terribly happy with it, but he wouldn't tell me why. Eric, over the phone, told me that he was crying when he read it, that he had no idea anyone else had ever read Kropotkin, that Kropotkin was his great hero, but he could never mention that or he'd be fired from every place he worked, that Kropotkin had to be a secret. And he said, here, David Hawk is devoting a chapter to anarchism and Kropotkin. It's fantastic. Anyway, based on that, it took 2 years for a committee of seven from around the university to approve the dissertation. When it was approved, it went to the dean of the Wharton School. The dean put out a memo saying, I will never approve this. This will never, never go to the library. I have no idea how environmental deterioration relates to business. There is no relationship. How can he do a dissertation on this? So anyway, they forced me to meet with the dean. During our meeting, I concluded by agreeing with him that he did not see the relationship between business and environmental deterioration. He's quite right. And I would never try to change his mind. He got totally furious at that, thinking I was being cynical, which I was. And he made sure that never went to the library and never went to Michigan. In retaliation, the students in SQ took it and published it as an SQ document, because they said, if the dean hates it that much, it must be all right. Anyway, that began a long process where the head of EPA sent me a personal letter, the large box containing all the volumes of my research that she could collect in North America, sent it to me and said, dear David Hawk, we have no further use of these reports, nor you. I will make sure no government money ever goes to funding your research. And what is this climate change crap you talk about? It's a wonderful letter I got. Anyway, that's very important for a stream of people that I met and got to work with. And on this handout that I have sent to Dan, I mentioned most of those people. And if you pass it on to them, they can see them. If you go into the book, don't buy it. Just go online on Amazon and you can read those pages where I comment on the 15, 20 people that were very important in this. And they include some quite interesting people, which I think you might enjoy knowing about. And they were fundamental to systems thinking, although you probably would never have associated them with systems thinking. One was co-designer of the hydrogen bomb, which has a remarkable book just published on him as the most creative genius you've the most creative scientist you've never heard of. Quite a good book.
Okay. Next up. So David, we're at the sort of the 1 hour 15 mark, a little bit later than I promised, but were there questions that people wanted to pose to David at this point?
One note on strategy is evil. In case you get very upset, particularly if you're into strategy, that comes mostly from Anatole Rapoport. And it comes out of game theory and comes out of him winning game theory on that run that was done by Axelrod that was in Scientific American, the rather famous article. And that in essence, he won the computer version of playing game theory by using tit for tat, which in essence is a non-strategic strategy because he's distinctly anti-strategy. And then they reran the competition and he won by an even larger margin. And so in my discussions with him, we were both pretty adamantly worried about strategy, where strategy in essence was evil. And in essence, if you want reassurance of how it started that way, go back and read Clausewitz, The Originator of Strategy and Warfare. I'm presently writing up what that means. I'm trying to get a friend to co-author it with me, but she says she'll lose her job and never be allowed to teach in a business school again if she's author of such a paper. But anyway, I'll share the paper when it's done.
So David, there's a question around AI, artificial intelligence. Perhaps you could talk about your perspective on that as far as, you know, what, how that might play into the future.
In essence, with, I lecture to boards every now and then. I've been advisor to a number of companies. For 15 years, I was senior advisor to China State Construction, where during that 15 years, they went from $30 billion a year to $200 billion a year. And a lot of these ideas come from discussions to and for them. And so this idea of being anti-strategic is very important for them. If any of you are on LinkedIn and you notice the nice postings that appear on LinkedIn about China State Construction and their workers and what their workers do and why their workers are in charge, that all comes out of this anti-strategic approach. Plus there are many other companies. The largest construction company in Europe, which you've never heard of, and 80% of French have never heard of it, even though it's a French company, is called Bouygues, because they're anti-marketing, anti-advertising, anti-strategy, and a phenomenal company. And I've lectured them on several occasions, taking groups of students to see them. And it's worth noting that on one of the trips we took, one of my EMBA students interrupted the speaker and said, "Have you heard of distinctive competence?" And the speaker said, "Yes." And the student says, "Well, obviously you don't know what it is because you make movies, you make internet technology, you run an internet system, you're the largest construction company in Europe, on and on and on. You obviously do not know of Harvard's distinctive competence theme." And he interrupted and said that, "Well, we do know of it. In fact, we hire many professors from leading schools in the world to come and lecture our executives at night. And we have this ongoing set of courses with people from Harvard, Wharton, Caltech, Stanford, et cetera, that come and lecture. And the reason we have them lecture is we have them come and teach their latest thinking. And we want to learn about it because we want to make sure we do none of it. So we're very meticulous to not do anything that they talk about. And distinctive competence is one of the reasons why we make sure we never have distinctive competence." So in the business school training, this sort of MBA is an interesting degree, but I think it doesn't prepare you well for the kinds of things you'll face, especially with the precursor to climate change that we happen to call the virus. And then, of course, climate change will be the big one. And what you learn in an MBA will not, I think, help you very much in that. So I'm rather sorry for that. But nonetheless, what's taught at Harvard, I generally use as an example of what not to do. By the way, I'm on their advisory board, in case you wondered. And so they humor me, and they send me articles. What do you think? Should we publish this or not? And I, of course, say no to everything. But they enjoy my humor.
So Zamina wanted to ask a question. I would ask Zamina to unmute and just go ahead and do that.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories, David. Quite fascinating. I feel like I could sit here and listen to several more. I noted in a lot of the stories, there were pivotal points where you were discouraged, especially in the academic space, from thinking the way that you do and pursuing the work in the way that you do. And I'm curious, on two aspects of that, like how do you, can you comment a little more about how that fueled your work or didn't, or, and also, would you say that overcoming that disagreement from status quo is what makes you such a prominent person in the systems thinking group?
Prominent. Mm-hmm. I know I'm disliked. I don't know. Prominent. No, I'm sort of kidding. For me, there's a fundamental distinction, or as Bateson would talk about in this search for differences that make a difference. For me, there's a fundamental difference between education and learning. And education is mostly what we're about, and that's quite sad. And for me, education is learning assumptions, memorizing assumptions. So throughout high school, you know, maybe when you're 6 years old, you're pretty bright and pretty spontaneous and pretty interesting. By 18, you're not so bright. You've learned all the assumptions that keep you in good stead, and people trust you and ignore you and whatever. So this idea of education as memorizing, acquiring assumptions is very important. On the other hand, we have learning. The essence of learning is questioning assumptions. And so I've always been one that questioned assumptions and enjoyed it immensely. And in my classes, I've always praised those students that question assumptions. This is a really bad example, but for my courses at NJIT, I would have almost all finals out at my home in Maplewood. And so for a final exam, I couldn't give a final exam. I didn't know how to do a final exam. So I required all students to give a 20-minute presentation of what they'd learned and why it matters. And if you have 150 students, it takes several days to go through that. And I would generally have them out at my home, where at the end of all of it, I would cook for them and things like that. And so I asked students to always question assumptions. And so some of the projects that students would do were phenomenal. I won't go into them, but they were mind-blowing. I just couldn't believe how good students were when they're allowed to ask questions. And so all my courses were based on asking questions. And in essence, troublesome questions were thought of much better. But this idea of the exam that is fundamental in education, which I think you're aware of, I had about 10,000 students at NJIT over 28 years. And halfway through, the provost of that place became furious that I was never giving exams, and I announced it. And he said, David, you will give an exam. It's an order, not a discussion point. And I said, but I don't know how to write an exam. I can't test what I teach. And he said, just do an exam. Anyway, I went back to class, not tearful, but sad, telling the class that we had to have an exam, that Gary Thomas is really, really angry. And just to go under the radar, we have to get out of his vision. I said, I don't know what to do. Think, and can you help me? So the next day, three students came in with a final exam for the course. And I looked at it, oh my God. And also it noted on the exam that since the provost didn't ask that your name be on it, you don't have to put your name on it, you just have to take it. So please, everybody take this final exam. Such things as how much does a good manager weigh? How much does a bad manager weigh? Please explain the difference in one paragraph. And it was 3 pages of questions of that. Or was Darwin an ape? Please explain. anyway, that exam I showed my friends at the Stockholm School of Economics, they all wanted it to give their students. Based on that, some friends at Harvard and back at Wharton, they wanted that exam. So an array of business school professors used that exam to give their students. Then we put together the results from all those students and ascertained that the ones that had passed highest were my students at NJIT, which in essence were losers. And the reason they judged them to be the best is because they most wanted to work with them. Based on their answers, those were the people they wanted to invest years with. And so that exam finally turned into a science paper, which 3 of us wrote and presented at a conference in Europe. But students are phenomenal if you encourage them to ask questions and cause trouble. Does that answer your question?
I have so many more, but I'll just leave it at that. Thank you so much.
You'll get a chance, Zamina, don't worry. Okay, I think Zad was next. Go ahead, Zad, unmute.
Sure, yeah. David Ng has been helping our learning circle kind of surface a lot of the histories. And one of around Eritrea and the work that they've been doing, one of the pieces that was really interesting is that it comes from Pepper with the contextualism. And I was wondering how that influences a lot of the ideas that seem to run core underneath kind of the natural order or negotiated order ideas that you have. It seems like there is some resemblance there. And I was wondering if that's direct or that's just a byproduct of working with Trist.
Sure. No. I and a student at the Helsinki University of Technology wrote a paper called Context is Everything. And that was our take on contextualism. And it was simply an expansion. Use much of Eric Trist and a few others and expanded on that. That in essence, without a context, you know, I don't know if you've read the 1965 Emery and Trist article on contextualism and environmental typologies. It's well worth reading. It's becoming more important with time, but this type 4 environment, which is known as the turbulent environment, is quite interesting. And David and I talk about it quite a lot, that in essence, in a type 4 environment, the actors are no longer the play. The stage set has become the play.
Right. And
climate change is the best definition of that I can give you. Climate change will be the stage set running the play. And the actors will have very little to do with it.
To take that metaphor a little further, is it consistent that like the idea of using texture as a way to better help understand some of the social sciences is some of the important shifts that we're starting to make to actually embrace the literally the aesthetics of it, the art of it?
Sure, of course. No. There's a great book by Ernst Fischer called Art Against Ideology that you might want to look up that goes into that in some depth and why art is the last best hope of bringing the contextual questions to question something that someone knows adamantly, but in essence, it's an ideology and it's probably wrong. And art is the best way to question that. But maybe another way of getting into that is another project David and I are working on, which is a tough one. It's called Both Plus More, which he's probably mentioned. And that's the idea that you have arguments between two ideologies or two points of view or whatever. And based on that argument, you know, one wins, one loses, one gets angry or kills himself or herself and moves on and, you know, all that crap. And winner gets to write a book about it and whatever. I think that's a sort of a dumb approach to being human and living life. And so a much better approach is including both opposites, or they're thought to be opposites, and finding a way for them to, in essence, come to about the same meaning, and then move on to more. Mm-hmm. And more is at a higher level, and more is where you need to go.
Right.
And so in some of the work I'm doing, which I'm not talking about to anybody, but in essence, it's about the importance of a fifth dimension. That zero dimension is in essence where politicians are. One dimension is sort of where the better politicians are. Two dimensions are lawyers, because they can't operate outside a sheet of paper. And so Abbott's Flatland is a phenomenal book you should read relative to the problem with lawyers, even though he doesn't mention lawyers. And lawyers, as essence, were the enemy of my research project. They were responsible for a lot of environmental deterioration in North America. But then you move to the third dimension, and you begin to have sort of the mess of life. But what is really exciting for me, and always has been, is the fourth dimension, which in essence is entropy. And the fourth dimension is quite exciting because it's one-dimensional. Okay, so the dimensions are not hierarchical. They're much more interesting than that. So we have this one-dimensional platform called the fourth dimension, which is entropy. And in essence, we're all going to shit. And there was a conference held in Canada in 81, which Carl Sagan and I were on the panel of, and we were talking about entropy. I from Negotiated Order, he from the Cosmos. He hadn't done his movies or his book at that time. And so he was very important for my thinking on what you just asked, and importance of context. And so Negotiated Order comes out of that context. In essence, is the cosmos. Humans, in essence, are screwed because of the fourth dimension. But I think there's something really exciting about the fifth dimension, mainly because humans have no damned idea what it is.
I won't overstay my question, but it's interesting to talk about both plus more and achieving a higher dimension, because I noticed, I think you referenced some Carl Jung as well, and sure. There's that idea about alchemy and chemistry that form. So I think that's a beautiful kind of resemblance there as well.
Yep. Thank you.
Yep.
I guess Joanne's next. And in fact, from what I could gather, Joanne's big on context. So this might be a good way to continue that discussion. Go ahead, Joanne.
Yeah, I have several questions. I'll ask just one. And I have to say, thank you for saying that art is humanity's last hope. And I would add beauty. I think I know where you came from. I read Alexander Christopher's books and so way back. So my question extending what Dan was saying about context. So basically is what we as individuals can do to make a difference in today's world. The context is we have this pervasive industrial mindset and model that's dominant in our societies and in our businesses, where most people are mere cogs in some machine. So, I mean, your life and career have been courageous and inspirational, to say the least. But then if you work in a corporate environment and you have a family to feed, what can individuals do? So I did study complexity theory on my own interest way back. And I just looking through, for example, in a social adaptive system, nature, like ant colony or migrating birds, there's no one looking over the global, at the global level. So it's true self-organizing in the sense that individual interactions make the difference, by following simple rules. Can we truly, as humans, and I'm a big fan of Carl Jung as well, I've read his books. So I started losing hope in many ways, which is not a good thing. You know, it gets you into depressive state often. So what we as individuals can do in a sense to make a difference. I mean, I can't influence politicians, government, I can't even influence company executives. So what's your insight on that? Thank you.
Thank you. I don't know if I have any insight. That's a tough one. That's the big one. I'm more or less down to the level of my last best hope is humor. And that humor is about the only way that I can deal with people and things around this. Before the book that came out last November was coming out, AAAS, American Association for Advancement of Science, the new director of it sent me a note asking me to please make a posting on a new internal website they're starting for members of AAAS. That he said he notices in the record that 2 years ago they had another organization, a company, run chat sites for them. And that I was banned from that chat site forever. As long as the president of that company existed, I could never be allowed to be on that site for whatever indiscretions I had pulled. And he said, you sound like a good person to open our new internal site that we'd like to be more open and more interesting. So I made a posting on there, very similar to your question. It was a one-liner, but in essence, it boiled down to your question that where do we find hope? And I outlined briefly the forthcoming book that was hopeless. To that posting on the AAAS site, around 800 scientists responded to it. The printouts are 2,200 pages long, and over 80% were more pessimistic than me.
Okay.
Was phenomenal. I didn't know what to do with that context, that I thought that things were not quite that bad. But based on that, AAAS changed its rules again. And once you got to 150 comments, you had to cut it off. There could be no more comments on that site and things like that. They cleaned up the pessimism and allowed for more hope. But in essence, humor is terribly important for me and many things I deal with. There's quite a lot of humor. And funny enough, I get to work with a lot of CEOs and a lot of companies and do a lot of things and find out that they are at least as pessimistic as I am. I think we could do much better, but we have a problem with leadership in that the kinds of people we choose for leadership are those that really, really, really want to be a leader. It's like a policeman. Anyone that wants to be a policeman should not be allowed to be a policeman. Anyone that wants to be a leader should be disallowed. By definition, they're not qualified if they really want it. And so I write quite a bit of stuff internally for companies on a concept that has upset some, but it hasn't taken off, I assure you. I've developed the concept of leadership as opposed to leadership. And I qualify what leadership is within a company and how do you detect it? What do you do about it? How do you deal with it? And there's a great deal of it. And so we usually describe it in some humor. But of course, everybody understands. It's one of those things you understand so well, you don't want to comment on it. And going back to Kropotkin, you might take a look at Mutual Aid or books like that. If you don't know Kropotkin, he was the Russian scientist, prince, cousin of the Tsar of Russia, who worked out in Siberia all the time. He would write articles against Darwin, saying that I just found a fox cuddling a bunny rabbit in the snow to keep both of them warm and survive. Mr. Darwin, can you explain what I should say about this? And so Kropotkin was quite, Kropotkin was the great enemy of Lenin.
I will definitely read him just he for would, that.
He would argue that revolution without leaders is desperately needed. We cannot have leaders, and there can never be any violence. Even discussion of violence will destroy the revolution. And you can imagine that was favorite reading of people like Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, etc. That was a bedside book for them. He was the original that argued why revolution's crucial, and violence cannot be part of it. And also why we have to be very careful of leaders. You know, why do we need someone to lead us? You know, why can't we try leading ourselves every now and then, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a long answer to your very good question. It's the big question. During climate change, the question will be, are the worst instincts of humans going to come out, or will we go back and find the better instincts? Right now, I'm pulling for the first. I don't see a lot of hope for the second. I think the traits that will emerge during climate change will really be nasty. If you talk about migration, Canada will have to build a wall to keep the damned Americans out. Next, I'm sorry. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I think Josh is next, if he's there.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to hear your thoughts, please, on what's our alternative out of perpetual growth economics.
Nature's been thinking about that. And it's probably not ecological economics. You know, that is a very important organization, and I'm sure they do important things. And I get about 20 papers a day all year long from them to look at and read and say that, well, this one matters. But I'm very much akin to Georgescu Rosen, Nicholas, my friend, that he was part of that research I did in Sweden for 2 years. That's where I first met him. And then I would have him come to conferences, even though he's banned from conferences, banned from everything, could never get the Nobel Prize in economics, et cetera, et cetera. But Georgescu Rosen's Entropy Law and Economic Process is a terribly important book. And when the board of the Ecological Economics Society met with him, they said, you're a natural to be head of this group. I don't know if you ever heard that story. At least his telling me of the story was he met with them and they wanted him to join and be an important head. And he declined. And he said, in the future, you will watch ecology eat economics. And that was his last comment to them. And so the economic system, I don't know, I think probably we give too much credence to the importance of economic systems. Certainly politicians do. That's how they manage people. But I have an idea that terms like capitalism and socialism, et cetera, are pretty tiring words that don't mean much. You know, trickle down theory. When I present it in a company, particularly to hardcore capitalists around the board table, I present it as horseshit theory. And the reason I do it is because there's three horses in my pasture outside. And of all the areas of shit, horse shit was less used by the consumer. So there's lots of really good stuff left in it. So when it comes out the other end, all kinds of animals live off of that, including my neighbor's dogs come over and live off of it.
Oh, man.
And so another version of trickle-down theory that captures them is horseshit theory. But in essence, I have this great sign that I use of trickle-down theory, which I don't know if you've seen. It's a billboard at the very top. It says trickle-down theory. And then as you drop down, a letter is missing from the right each time as you go deeper into trickle-down theory. And the last sentence is trick. And that's the end of it.
That's concrete poetry reminds me of concrete poetry.
Yes, I know. Yes. So what economic system? I don't know. I've more or less come down to the notion of just be nice and don't be strategic. Strategic means, in essence, you have a plan of something you're now doing is going to pay off vis-a-vis some other way. But vis-a-vis Clausewitz, you can tell no one about it, not even your aides. You can't even trust them. So in essence, you do something make-believe as a strategy in order to accomplish something else. In other words, it's trickery. And Clausewitz even said, if it doesn't involve deceit, it's not strategic. So in essence, the alternative is being nice, which is pretty tough, and not being strategic. And there's much more of that comes out in other projects I've been working on. But I know that everybody wants to be strategic and have it on their resume and even get a degree in it, etc. Since 92, I've been lecturing against strategy and haven't made much progress, except in a few companies like Bouygues and a few like that. And early on in IKEA, I was senior advisor to IKEA for many years and helped them come to America and set up in Philadelphia, then Jersey, whatever. And back then they emphasized being non-strategic and did very well. Lately they become, of course, strategic. And to do so well in China, they have to be, they say.
Okay, thanks, Josh. I think Nishad has a question for you, David. Nishad?
Hi, Nishad.
Not really. I won't ask the question.
Yes, no?
Sorry, you didn't want to ask a question, Nishad? I missed that.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay.
So I have a question, if I may.
Sure.
This is a tremendous opportunity, and thank you very much for all the wonderful stories. I loved your thermodynamics story. Takes me back to being an undergraduate, remembering how magnificent thermodynamics was. When we look at systems, we should always look for the negentropy wealth. Now, we don't want to ignore the entropy waste, but it's the negentropy wealth that keeps living organisms living, that's Schrödinger, and keeps systems systeming. What's your position on negentropy wealth?
I'm very much in the camp of Einstein and one of his followers called Stephen Hawking, and they're both pretty clear about, of all the laws in the universe that are meaningful, the most meaningful one is the second law of thermodynamics. If somebody comes with you with a means for developing negentropy, you should get away from them as fast as possible. Either they are extraordinarily dumb or they're out to cheat you, and you don't yet know the means which they're going to use to cheat you. And I've used that in business schools to talk about the essence of the marketing class is to teach negentropy, that everything in marketing is to pretend entropy doesn't exist. Because once you introduce entropy into marketing, it's not the same. And so that goes back again to what would you do to make an economic system better or different? And I would argue that negentropy, a war on negentropy ideas should be foremost. As a footnote, you might know that in the US, we can't have negentropy because US Congress passed a law back in the 30s saying negentropy cannot exist. if it exists, you can't have a patent on it. That's a great law to have in a nation. It shows how bright the people are that are running it. But neg entropy is a big deal for me. And well, there's a, forgive me for a slight story that if students aren't depressed, I use this story on the purpose of humans and why we're going away. It has to do with law of nature is that entropy goes on and on and on, and there's nothing to do about it except try to understand it and try not to add too much to it. And nature was quite content with that law. But then nature found a problem on planet Earth in that there's all of this fossil fuel, oil and gas hidden underground that was not being released vis-a-vis the second law of thermodynamics. And in essence, it was not coming out. It was being trapped and staying there forever. And Mother Nature was quite upset about this, that her fundamental law was being violated. She didn't know what to do. After much thought, she finally came upon the solution. She created humans. So humans had a purpose of getting that locked energy set free so entropy could go back to business again. And then, of course, nature is a footnote put down. And of course, when it's all set free, I'll get rid of humans. There's no more need for them.
I'm so glad I asked the question.
Of course, that's a funny story. It's a tough thing. The people I most respect have this comment about it for everybody, if you're not a fan of studying entropy. First time you look at it, you'll have no idea what it is, but it's sort of intriguing. Second time you study entropy, you'll think, aha, I'm going to get it. I am going to understand this. Third time you look at it, you'll think, there is no way in hell I'm ever going to understand entropy. The fourth time you look at it, you decide, and there's no way I can ever forget it and move on. And Hawking, Einstein, others wrote stories quite sympathetic to that belief. It's a tough one. And it's the one that humans really dislike. And I think it's the one that's at the essence of this really terrible book you should never read, that won the Pulitzer Prize in nonfiction in 1974, called Denial of Death, where the author describes all evil comes from people discovering they're going to die, and they develop an immortality project to pretend they're not dying. And those immortality projects are the basis for evil. It's quite a book. You won't recover if you ever read it. It's depressing beyond my book.
I feel like I could have written it.
It's a tough one. And by the way, his second book after that was Escape from Evil, on how to solve that problem. And halfway through, he died.
I'm a systems analyst by background, so I always go for specifics, right? So if you mention an immortality project, I immediately switch to the list, right?
Yes.
So these are the following projects which I'm promising you: immortality, Christianity.
Yes.
Yes. Islam. Yes. We can continue the list.
Yes, yes, of course. Even science. And there's great books on why science is a religion as well.
So David, just as a checkpoint, we're at about 8:27, which is basically 2 hours into our thing. Now, I know there's some few people that still want to ask questions. You know, Zamina had some questions, and I think David also has some. But I just thought I'd give you the opportunity now to suggest to people that we might have a follow-up meeting to kind of, what, if you want to say it this way, review what you've written in your book there, or if you don't want to do that, whatever your sort of inclination is, maybe you could share that before we sort of give people a chance to ask you more questions and other people who might want to do some other things in life.
Sure. No, I'm spending my time now trying to write a book on how to commit suicide and not fail. I'm kidding. But it's to give people have a lot of trouble with. I'd like to hand them a copy. And
not going to make me do that story about your daughters and going to dinner, are you now? Are you going to do that story?
No. My daughters refuse to go to dinners with me, and my family refuse to go to dinner with me, because I always start conversations with waitresses and with people in the restaurant. Usually the cook comes out and joins the conversation, and my daughters are tired of it. They want to have just dinner. And anyway, so be it.
All right. So as I said, we can, I guess you'll be hanging around for a while, David. Is that, are you making that offer?
Sure. No, I'm fine. I've been around David for a long time, and David Ng is quite a collaborator, cohort, friend, etc.
Yeah, he's going to ask that dreaded question that I wanted to ask you about legal and lawful order. So for the rest of the folks that don't want to watch this part of the discussion, you're free to. I know that you've made commitment to be here for the 8:30, but I didn't want to hold you to more time. So thank you, any rate, for sharing your time with us. We're going to get some more questions, I think.
Okay.
So I think David, go, David.
Okay, so there is this Parangangas Ng Hawk article, a negotiated order and network form organizations. And reading recently, I never made the connection between Emory and Trist, where they talk about lawful relations, and legal order. Would you like to clean this up for us?
Sure. Lawful relations are at a higher order of thinking than legal order. They would not touch legal order. They agreed with me that legal order is the stuff of lawyers, the stuff of government, the stuff of trying to get people to do what they don't normally do. And so you have laws which, you know, and then use regulation to enforce the laws. And so they were very much with me on my concern about that. They didn't realize it had such an impact on increasing environmental deterioration until they saw the three volumes that came out of that study. They had never made the connection, particularly with US trained lawyers espousing legal order. Whereas lawful order is generally a good thing, at least if you can discover what it is. It has more to do with cosmos, more to do with how things work, how they don't work, how you put things together. Lawful in terms of higher and lower levels of existence. And probably the best person I know to talk about lawful order was, what's his name, Carl Sagan. That I'd mentioned Carl Sagan and I were on a joint panel many, many years ago. And at the end, someone had asked about the lawful order of the universe and what it means relative to David Hawk's favorite subject, entropy. And so Carl Sagan responded, yes, indeed. That is the lawful order of the universe as we know it, based on the entropy law. But what I finally come to believe with absolutely no evidence is that as the universe expands, entropy continues and continues and continues, but at some point it reaches the end. And at the end, the lawful order of entropy reverses itself and goes the opposite direction. And then the entire universe will be neg entropy. And so everything will be neg entropy. And that will be the new lawful order. And so I often use that piece of humor by him. I think he meant it humorously or as a way to keep from committing suicide or whatever. But in essence, he helped clarify the lawful order construct comes very much out of the cosmos and understanding of the cosmos, as well as human interactions. Legal order is a made-up order. If you don't know what I mean, I think I mentioned to Dan that for my 5 legal cases against NJIT, I had to look for a special lawyer, and I finally found a lawyer based on reading their submissions to courts and the conclusions. And this lawyer wrote the most 125 word sentences I'd ever seen. And 125 word sentences law is where you don't know what you want to say, but you just jump in and start saying it. Then as you say it, you don't know how the hell to get out of it. So you just keep talking. And then at some point you just dump it and walk away from it. That's the essence of lawful order. And so I used that poor lawyer for five cases to find out how bad lawyers were. And he was phenomenal. He was very good at what legal order meant. And that takes you back to the two-dimensional existence. If you read Flatland, that's what it is like to live in legal order.
Thanks. Dan?
Does it mean it's still there? Maybe she left?
No, I'm here.
Well, ask your question.
I feel like I should have written down my follow-up questions. I guess the questions were budding more out of curiosity, just because I currently work in an academic space, and I'm thinking about ways in which, as not an instructor, I'm currently a project manager, so I'm not on the academic side, like how, I guess, thinking about ways in which I can contribute to injecting more of the learning rather than the education that you speak of. So yeah, I mean, it's not so much a question, it's a curiosity and request for guidance, I guess, almost about how to tackle that, really.
If you find out, will you let me know? I would love to know.
No, I was kind of looking to you, but I guess.
No, it's terribly important. For me, it's mostly vis-a-vis colleagues, friends, whatever, just discussing lots of stuff. And then when I get frustrated, I go out and do a building project. I love to build things. So I go out and build. I built much of the house that I'm in now. For the last 3 years, I've been building a deck all the way around the house. And then during that process of building things, it helps the thinking. So it's sort of the ultimate combination of empiricism and rationalism, that when you're empirically doing something, you in essence begin to think about what you're doing. And and my deck is meaningful to me, whereas the other comes and goes and just confuses a lot. And it's also, as a footnote, it's the first third of the deck. A neighbor who thought I shouldn't have such a big deck notified the county. The assessor came and did an evaluation on the first part of my deck and evaluated at $50,000. It cost $1,500 for the lumber. And he decided it was worth $50,000. So when I went to talk to him about how it could be worth $50,000, he says, "It's very nice. I really like it." That was it. So I didn't appeal. So how do you do with this relationship between rationalism and empiricism? And that was the fundamental question again for Wes Churchman, Russell Acuff, many of those systems people. And they did their best to ensure that, as they argue in Acuff's dissertation of 1950, Methods of Inquiry, the entire book is about the history of science, where for a while we'd go with empiricism as the basis for truth. For a while we go with rationalism as the finder of truth. And they pointed out, in history, there were very few integrations of the two, but during those integrations is when progress was made. When one or the other was in charge, not much progress was made. It's pretty dumb and ugly, but during those brief moments. So they argued very much about the combining of them, and Acuff's not so much in that camp. Churchman is very much in that camp. And if you get a chance to read his book, The Systems Approach and Its Enemies, you'll read much more before he died about the importance of that camp and your question as well. That he was a very good thinker. Along with that, I would encourage you to read more of Vickers. Vickers was quite good. Also read more of The Idea of History, Collingwood, R.G. Collingwood, also of Cambridge. All three of them have this comment of, when you meet the enemy, dig deeper, go deeper. Or if you don't have an enemy, go deeper into what you're thinking. And eventually, when you get deep enough, you'll find you and your enemy are pretty close. Actually, there's an awful lot of similarities. And that takes us back to this both plus more. So in essence, the things that you really disagree with, look at deeper and see how they relate to the things that you really feel strongly for. And in essence, once you can find some sort of relationship, perhaps not a marriage, between those two, then you can move on to more. And more is where it's at. And I talk about the fifth dimension only as a way to get people not to talk to me. But more can have many, many locations. It's a good place to think about it. For me, what we're going to do in climate change is very much the more. Things are going to be extraordinarily different. And most humans will not make it through, if any.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, David, I think Joanne was listening very intently because it sounds like she has another question. So go ahead, Joanne.
Thank you very much. So you, just to your comment at the beginning, that China should get out of Confucianism and get into Taoism, Laozi. So I've studied chaos theory. So the essence of being grown up in China myself for 25 years. So I've lived in Canada much longer than I've lived in China, but I did grown up in Mao's communist, very, very horrific time. So my question is, because according to Taoism, the safe place is really on the edges of order and chaos. So that to me really connects with systems thinking. You know, too much changes, too much revolution, for example, you leads to chaos. That's hurricanes, that's tornadoes. You know, too much order, you have too much stillness. That's very much Confucianism, which I've long thought. So when I heard that, I thought, wow, that's you know, I've never thought of that. I've always thought, what's wrong with Confucianism? And there's everything wrong with it. But have you ever, in your research, connected systems thinking with chaos theory, which is the odd, you know, how to stay on the edge in between order and chaos, the classic symbol of yin and yang in Taoism, which is really half and half. You know, the yin symbol is the feminine representation, and mm-hmm. the yang is the masculine representation, which is quite fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's an important way to say it. The chaos term is a bit of a loaded term. It can mean good and bad. For people like Collingwood in his book, Metaphysics, just like Vickers, they both talk about dealing with the principles that underlie what someone's saying and what they believe. And as you go deeper, you approach a sort of chaos within which they're drawing from. But it's a chaos of a good sort. It's not the nasty chaos that we're talking about relative to climate change and hurricanes and those things.
Right.
And so within my work, I align Socrates very much with Lao Tzu. I align Plato and Confucian as sort of the same pile.
Right.
They are trying the same stuff and they're trying to make leaders happy. But then moving beyond or beneath them, I like very much the distinction between Heraclitus and Parmenides.
Okay.
Parmenides is the essence of change.
Right.
That he argues by definition that only look at that which is alive. That which is alive is what changes. If it doesn't change, it's dead. Forget about it. It's of no interest. On the other hand, his opponent, Heraclitus, argued only worry about that which doesn't change. Because if it changes, by definition, it's not there anymore. It's moved on. So don't waste your time on anything that changes. So in essence, I use that distinction an awful lot working with scientists on which way do they lean. Are they Heraclitian or are they Parmenidean in their takeoff? And a really nice book that's terribly depressing. I only know of depressing books. A book called The Heraclitian Fire.
Okay.
It's from the chief biochemist at Columbia University for 20, 30 years. And upon leaving, he wrote that book about leaving the university and the idiots in the university, particularly the managers. And then he has a chapter on DNA, where he was the one that had the double helix, which Crick and Watson, when they interviewed everybody in order to win a Nobel Prize, they knew nothing about anything, but he was the ones they interviewed and got the double helix from. And so he comments in that book that in order for their immortality project, they wanted a Nobel Prize. So very much like in ancient Greece, there was a temple that was the most beautiful temple humans had ever envisioned and built. And some man came along and burnt down the temple so humans would remember his name forever. That was his immortality project. His final comment in his book is, I feel like the person that handed the matches to that guy by giving the double helix to Crick and Watson. And so The Heraclitian Fire is a tough read, but very good.
I will check it out. Thank you.
You won't feel better after it.
That's okay. I've read enough depressive ones myself.
But Socrates and Lao Tzu, for me, are quite similar. And look what they did to Socrates. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for your questions.
Anyone else out there that we haven't covered in terms of questions? Not hearing anything so far, David.
Good, good.
You may have tired them out.
No, and we pretty well covered the list. Couple of those pictures you showed were very important of Gunnar Hedlund, my friend. But each summer we would go to Lapland, that's above the Arctic Circle in northern Sweden. And we'd have a plane fly us into a lake and we'd spend 2 weeks walking 200 kilometers back to civilization. And generally we'd never see another person during that 2 weeks. Now all the glaciers we used to walk on are gone. And it's all different up there now. But relative to systems thinking, Gunnar and I thought those 2 weeks in nature were terribly important for systems thinking. That it's hard to avoid systems the rest of the year.
David, if you've got another minute.
Sure.
I didn't want to, this is Peter, I didn't want to ask like the last question that would go on, but I did have kind of a question about your experience with China and the Belt and Road Initiative and what you felt that China's capacity might be for mitigation effects in climate change planning. I mean, they take a 100-year plan to them is like, maybe not like a short-term plan, but it's like, you know, for them, it's, you know, they've got longer-term plans than that. So yep. how are they positioning themselves from a large systems perspective, and how are they taking into account some of your ideas with respect to resilience and not over planning, not over determining their response to climate?
Yeah, and a major problem that civilization or society as it's now defined faces is what to do about air travel. And air travel is a tough one. All those jets and the fuel they burn is a real problem for climate issues. And so part of the response, at least within our discussions, when I was senior advisor to them for many years, we discussed many things, and many of them in humor, of course. But this idea of the beltway that no one else will ever tell you this, but in essence, that's designed to become a high-speed rail before too long. But in essence, it will not be for cars and trucks, and it will be to replace airplanes. And so the beltway is sort of humans' last effort to find a way to be international, yet not screw up the climate so badly. So the beltway is that project. Not sure if that surprises you or is obvious, but
it really makes sense given the Silk Road trails that have been in place for, you know, a couple thousand years, and that these are, you know, existing pathways throughout human history. That's going to, I mean, there's a possibility for them to have a, you know, to lead a completely different kind of civilization there, if that's the case. And I am, and I'm watching how the West is really pushing them and Russia away. And by pushing them away, it seems like we're actually giving them, it's a large system response that they're being almost given the freedom to go ahead and to do something better without having to negotiate everything with us.
Yep. No, I mean, I obviously have trouble with their government because of my humor and touch of anarchism. And they like to put such people in jail, although I'm too humorous to put in jail. And nonetheless, but we do have such discussions, but their attempt in Hong Kong is unfortunate. But they consider Hong Kong noisy. And of course it is noisy, but that's why I like Hong Kong. But on the other hand, climate change for them is a really big deal. And much of their breadbasket next to Shanghai, to the west, will be underwater before too long. And things like that are well known and I wouldn't say accepted, but there's not much to do about it anymore. The rising oceans are quite clear. And Chinese leadership is very aware. This debate I talked about with the Experts Council, that was started because of my work on climate change. And so in essence, that was the prime motivator of that debate. That's why I thought Lao Tzu could do more with it. But tough subject, tough issue. And I liked working with them because of their leadership. And I liked the way they dealt with people. I liked China Construction. I helped them pick a firm to buy in the US because I told them eventually there's going to be, shall we say, an ethnic war. That once Americans get tired of war on blacks, they'll do war on Asians. And then eventually they'll get to Mexicans and others. But it would be in your interest to probably have an American company working in North America. And then we did, going back to David Ng and the lawful versus legal issue, that they asked me to be in charge of due diligence for buying a $5 billion firm in New York. And so I agreed to do it on the basis that as we buy this company, no lawyers can be involved. So at the very end, the company we were buying and China Construction's lawyers can review the documents that we put together, but they are not allowed to substantially change them. And they certainly are not allowed to be at the table in any discussions about the purchase. They didn't quite know why, but they accepted, based on past experience, that we would do that. So we did that. That turned into one of the greatest acquisitions in New York City, in terms of almost no one being fired except for the CEO of the new company, and tremendous harmony between the two sides. And in fact, the work they've done together is phenomenal and makes a lot of stories. They just received the Engineering Society's Award of the Year for the new structure they built in Miami, and they buy the company they acquired. And the friendship between those two is phenomenal. Only the lawyers were angry at the end. And I pointed out at the very end, the reason I did that is because lawyers look for reasons to make money. In essence, they do conflict all the way along. And you end up with a merger and acquisition that's only an acquisition, can't be a merger. There's no friendship in it. It's just a lot of hatred. And so it was a wonderful example to show if people want to get along and the basis is to get along, they do. If the basis is legal order, you're screwed. You might as well not do it. And so that particular example of China Construction buying that company is important in New York City. And a lot of lawyers would love to shoot me. It set a new tone in how to do a merger.
Can I ask a quick question about legal order and lawful order?
Sure.
You talked about it and about Carl Sagan.
Yep.
So I can see the appeal of legal order. It's pretty easy and simple to define rules, set them down on paper, have them as a nice little system. How do you discover lawful order in the universe?
Smile and trust Carl Sagan and Einstein and Hawking and such people that in essence, you read their work, read their sense of humor every now and then. Maybe not so much Stephen Hawking. His is pretty brutal. I don't know if you ever read the comment of humans essentially are slime on the earth.
Yes.
He goes into some detail on why they're slime and why they're arrogant slime. But in essence, I read a lot of scientists' work on their search for, shall we say, lawful order. But right now I'm having a somewhat bad discussion with a bunch of AAAS people on the virus and how the virus relates to climate change and why I think virus is just a test case from nature. And I use the term Mother Nature a lot just because it irritates them, because it's anti-science, they say. But I say I like her anyway, so it's not her fault. And so we've been talking about the virus. And then a Chinese scientist who had been instrumental in discovering the vaccine last time around in 2003, he entered the debate and he talked about there's actually 45 more viruses on track. Each one is more interesting. And I'm not gonna say who designed them, but there really are more coming. And this one is relatively simple compared to the next ones. And then I raised the question online, do you think nature is bored with humans or really pissed off? And that's led to a lot of commentary on lawful order. So I tend to mix up the two. There are problems with science. There are problems with scientists. There is an arrogance in the religion of science, which is bothersome. And Carl Sagan certainly didn't have it. He was quite humorous and very much hated by many scientists, mostly because he was popular. don't know if that answers your question, but it's sort of a tough thing, this lawful order, and who decides? Certainly not the journals, although they say they do.
So David, we've got Kelly who wants to ask a question. She wants to try to get in there. So go ahead, Kelly.
Sure.
Hey, because you mentioned Mother Earth and also the Eternal Feminist Foundation, mm-hmm. Do you think do you know the term chthilocene?
Mm-hmm.
And is there, because it has a feminist, philosophy to it, and it goes back to indigenous wisdom. Is there value in there? And I don't think it's a strong current, and especially on a science basis, but there are parts of it that I like.
Sure. No, I deal with that somewhat jokingly, but it seems to be a bit helpful sometimes. For me, there are two main actors. We have Mother Nature and Father Time. And I give Father Time the entropy law and the fourth dimension. That's his problem. And he raises holy hell in the fourth dimension. And then we have Mother Nature, which is one, shall we say, ring above that, trying to make sense out of it. And so it's not just Mother Nature. But the more interesting scientists have no trouble with this. Middle ground scientists are infuriated about the concept of Mother Nature. They just go freaky, and they get even angrier when they go to that website on the Eternal Feminine, which no man should go there because it makes fun of men. It's a terrible site about men. You just, especially the Donald Trump pictures, you just avoid that website. But in essence, the theme is that men were ruled by masculinity, in part because the women told them to be that way. And women were ruled by feminine values. And so in this foundation we started, I argued that feminine are values, not sex. So there are many men that are at least as feminine as many women. And even worse, there are many women that are more masculine than many men. And so when I run into one of these masculine women, like I often do on chat sites, they're much tougher than the men. So in essence, it's how not to have a dualism, but include more than just feminine. Include more of the context, if you will. Does that make sense? No. But just remember, Mother Nature, Father Time. Father Time is the tough one.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess it's 9 o'clock now, so I'm going to, in the interest of saving some things for the next time, I think we'll thank everybody, call it a night.
Mm.
We'll have the recording available, but also I'll huddle with the Davids here to see, what we can do to continue the discussion in a way that maybe we can work on some of those things that David Hawks raised tonight. Even. How's that sound?
Good. And if anyone commits suicide before next time,
okay.
Let's at least have their picture posted.
That's so not your fault, I know. Let's
yes. Good. No, it's a pleasure to meet all of you. I greatly enjoyed it. I don't know how to say thank you. Whatever I'd say would be feeble. I think very highly of you and really appreciate your values and concern.
So the other David, do you have something to say to close us down, close us off?
So I just want to make the note that next month, System Thinking Ontario, we'll be featuring Zad Khan, who will be fresh from defending his major research project at OCADU. So I'll be posting that very soon.
Good.
Good. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, David.
Thank you very much, thank you. David. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Bye. Thanks. Have a good night.
Bye.